Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Spoolcast. And, you know, there are some guests that I could talk to forever, but I promise you we're going to keep this not that long, but it'll be just as fun. We're going to talk today to Mr. Brad Frost. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brad Frost. Brad, how are you?
I am fantastic. How are you doing?
Brad will be presenting a day-long workshop at UX Immersion Mobile April 13th through 15th in Salt Lake City. For more information, visit uxim.co.
I am doing wonderfully and really excited to be able to talk to you today.
Excellent, as am I.
So let's talk about this atomic design thing. So this is not designing the Big Bang of the universe.
Yes, first step, dig out a Large Hadron Collider in your backyard.
So the joke I heard the other day was that scientists have a tradition. Every 16 million years, they get together and build a Large Hadron Collider.
That's great.
Yeah. And the other quote I heard recently was a Carl Sagan quote that said that if you really want to make an apple pie from scratch, you have to start with a Big Bang.
Yeah. Yep. You first have to invent the universe. That's right. Yeah.
But this is not what we're talking about here. You're not talking about inventing the universe, right? The web already exists.
Right. Yeah.
We're just picking up where other people have left off.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the story, how it sort of landed on the phrase atomic design, is I started to look at a lot of, you know, sort of breaking down interfaces in a more systematic way, instead of just sort of this loose spray of modules and includes and stuff. We love that word, modules. This is very sort of amorphous concept and blob of stuff. I was a little frustrated with that. And so I kept sort of looking to other areas for inspiration. And I sort of kept coming back to my high school chemistry class, how we had to do a bunch of chemical equations, balancing chemical equations, sort of learning all about, you know, sort of atomic elements and how those things combine to form molecules, and they keep combining to form sort of, you know, basically all matter in the known universe is all sort of comprised of these sort of finite set of atomic elements. And so I kept coming back to that as I was thinking about our interfaces. And that's what sort of led to what I'm now calling atomic design. So basically applying that same process that happens in the natural world, right? Atoms become molecules, which keep combining to form more complex molecules. Eventually sort of simple organisms are created, and then those organisms sort of keep combining until we end up with, you know, the richness of the universe. So applying that to our interfaces, right? Where we as people creating for the web are sort of starting with that same set of finite building blocks, right? Those Lego blocks, those sort of atomic elements are, you know, HTML tags, right? You know, things like headings and table cells and form inputs and labels and things like that, right? These sort of basic tags that can't be broken down any further without losing their meaning. And then those tags, right, those basic tags in conjunction with things like color swatches and font stacks and sort of animation defaults, right, all these very elemental aspects of our interfaces start combining together and becoming more useful. So that's basically what atomic design is sort of starting with these atoms and sort of thinking about things as this sort of blown apart concept, right? Is, you know, what are our Lego bricks? What are our raw materials for building an interface? And using that as a starting point and then combining them together. So there's five distinct steps in atomic design. There's sort of the atoms, which I just described. And then there's molecules, which are, you know, what I call molecules, which are essentially just relatively simple components, relatively simple clusters of interface, right? So a quick example of this is, you know, like a search form, right? So you have a label for the search form that says search the site or something. You have an input, which is where you type, right? And then you have a button that actually submits the form, right, to, you know, trigger the search. So that's three things, right, all sort of wrapped in a form tag. And that sort of serves as this relatively simple standalone piece of interface. And then you could take that relatively simple piece and plug that into context, right? Say, you know, very often a site search is in the header of a website, right? So now you could basically plug that relatively simple component into a more complex component, right? This header, this global header, what I call organism, right? So an organism is a more complex piece of interface, right? And that a header organism might be comprised of, you know, a logo atom, a primary navigation molecule, right? A search form molecule. So it's this sort of relatively complex standalone chunk of interface that sort of becomes its own sort of autonomous piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, like a login box or something like that.
Right, yeah. So that would be part. So that login box might be, you know, a relatively simple component. So I'd call that maybe a molecule that lives inside this sort of broader.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Bigger component
of the header. So if we had a place where in your banner, you might have a username and password field that has a login button, and the three of those are the molecule, and then the organism is the bigger banner.
Yep. Yeah, precisely. And it's not hard and fast. And I've had quite a few conversations with people, and they're like, oh, sometimes, you know, it's a little bit of a fuzzy line. Oh, should this be a molecule? Should this be an organism? And really, you know, my basic advice is, you know, don't rack your brain too hard about it. It's more about just sort of, you know, chucking things out and sort of including smaller things inside of bigger things and stuff. And so, you know, sometimes it gets a little gray. So like with a login form, it's like, yeah, there's a couple more pieces to the puzzle in there, but it's still sort of a relatively simple sort of thing. But that's sort of basically the progression, is sort of, you know, having these sort of, you know, what's essentially like nested includes, right? Sort of, you know, little things included in bigger things, included in even bigger things. And then sort of taking that to the next step, which is where we sort of break the atomic design sort of analogy, this sort of chemistry analogy, is getting into things that clients understand and your teammates understand. So the next two steps are templates and then pages. If you go all the way with the whole chemistry metaphor, people think you're nuts. I sort of learned that the hard way. It's like, eventually you have to remind your clients and your teammates that, yeah, we're actually making a website. So maybe going all the way with this sort of, you know, chemistry sort of thing, it just doesn't make sense. But yeah, so we're being deliberate. We're in creating these components and including them in a sort of a thoughtful, meaningful way. And then you eventually take these relatively complex components, these organisms, and start stitching those together to form what ultimately becomes, you know, the final sort of page. But at this template level, it's not the final step of the process. This template level, what we're doing here is, one, sort of establishing, you know, the layout and all of that stuff. But the big thing at the template level is concentrating on the content structure of the interface rather than, you know, the actual living, breathing sort of content. And I see this happen a lot, especially in the sort of traditional Photoshop sort of waterfall design process, where basically, you know, every visual designer, they create a design and it looks beautiful and everybody's name is Sarah Smith without an H, right? You know what I mean? It just fits so nicely onto like one line. And of course, you know, their profile picture looks like it was cut out of a magazine and all of that stuff. And, you know, everything is perfectly filled out and all of that stuff. And it's like, in the real world, obviously, that just doesn't happen, right? Those best case scenarios don't happen. And so what this template level is here for is to sort of prevent what has historically happened, where, you know, once the PSD gets cut out and integrated into the back end system, only to find that everything just breaks and falls apart really quickly, because again, it's not a perfect world, you know, where everybody's name is 8 characters long. That's what this sort of template level is meant to do. It's like, what are the character lengths, right, for someone's name, right? What are the character lengths for our headlines, right? What are our image dimensions that we're working with? How many distinct sections and stuff do we have, and sort of what patterns are we using to sort of create this template? And so that's sort of the main reason why this template level is so important, because it just, it keeps people focused on the underlying structure of the content rather than getting distracted with whatever stock photo you happen to end up dropping into your design. So that's the template level. And then really it's at that page level where that template sort of comes to life and you actually pour in, you sort of replace that FPO content, those placeholder images and stuff, with real representative content. And this is obviously, you know, what your end users are going to see, right? This is what the end users are going to interact with. And then this is also, of course, what your clients and your bosses and stuff are going to sign off on. Why this page level is so important. So basically what we're doing is we're taking these templates and then we're pouring in this real representative content to, yes, show the final sort of visual design and all of that stuff, but more importantly, to sort of prove and sort of kick the tires and basically demonstrate how resilient the system is. All right, so you're creating these simple components, you're creating these complex components, you're creating these templates, but does this system hold up, right? The idea of sort of modular design, it's like, how do all of those modules come together? And does it look good? Does it function well whenever all the pieces are stitched together and real content is actually poured in inside them? It's at that level that you're able to sort of test the resiliency of the system. And if things fall apart, then you can go through and change things at a more atomic level.
Now, when you started this, this was really just how you were working, and you started to tell people about it, and it really took off. I mean, it's the last year or so. Dude, you're everywhere. This has been big. The North Koreans are afraid of you.
I hope so. Yeah, it's been really rewarding to go to a bunch of different places. I have been everywhere. I've been sort of living in airplanes pretty much for the last year. You know, going over to different countries and seeing, you know, people using atomic design for, you know, some of Europe's biggest airlines, and, you know, seeing even places like Twitter and stuff, while they're not using the exact same sort of language, they're definitely sort of using that methodology, you know, sort of breaking things out a bit further than just like, here's a bunch of modules and we put them together to sort of form this thing. So, and that's sort of why I like this methodology so much, is that you don't need the atoms, molecules, organisms sort of language so much. It's more about, you know, the thought process and using what works for your organization. So I've heard people call them elements, blocks, and modules, or elements and components and then blocks. You know, names are sort of arbitrary. I happen to like the chemistry analogy just because it has an implicit hierarchy within it. Because I've had people come up to me and say, oh, well, you know, why didn't you just call them, you know, atoms, modules, and then components? And then the next person comes up to me and says, well, why didn't you call them atoms, components, and then modules? And it's like, exactly. You know, those sort of names are a little arbitrary, and that's why I like this sort of nomenclature for it. But yeah, it's been super encouraging to see people really take it on and use it to craft an effective interface system for their organization. And just yesterday, actually, this education startup, Future Learn, they just sort of released theirs and sort of are showing their atoms, molecules, and organisms. They wrote a blog post about, you know, how they made it happen, how just thinking about things in a different way, in this sort of atomic way, in this very sort of deliberate way, really helped them establish a common language that they could all sort of get behind and rally behind and stuff. And that's just, it makes me super happy to read stuff like that. So it's great.
So in the year since you last did the workshop for us at last year's UX Immersion Conference, which was this huge hit, has your thinking shifted? Are there things you learned? Is there something that is new, or is this basically codified the way you imagined it would be, and it's working out the way that you thought atomic design was going to be is actually how it should be?
Yeah, I think that sort of the first year of thinking this way was definitely sort of buttoning up the methodology and seeing if it actually worked. It actually began its life as sort of four distinct steps. It was basically atoms, molecules, organisms, and then pages. And then very quickly that all fell apart. And so the template level was added. And basically I've been working this way now ever since last year at your event. It's basically proved its worth and has held up really well. And I've applied it to all the projects that I've been working on. But again, sort of traveling around and talking to all sorts of different organizations that have sort of, you know, taken this stuff to heart. And it's really seems to be working out really well for lots of people. So that's awesome. The big thing that's been happening for this last year has been, you know, again, sort of validating the methodology by working on real projects with it. So, you know, we launched timeinc.com, sort of doing a big redesign of that site, which really was the first time I sort of used Atomic Design and Pattern Lab, the tool that we created with Dave Olson, to actually really make this stuff happen in a big way. It's also applying it with a product I was working on, more of like sort of an app type thing, and a few other projects as well. And it's just been wonderful. And all the while, you know, we've been sort of collecting case studies and resources and sort of seeing more and more people release their pattern libraries and sort of style guides out in the open. So one of the big projects that sort of came from that, I've sort of been silently collecting a lot of that stuff in the background. And as it turns out, a few other people, including Anna Debenham over based in the UK, she was doing the same, and she wrote a really phenomenal book on front-end style guides, as of that name, for front-end style guides is the name of the book. And so we got together. I said, you know, it'd be great if we can sort of make a website that sort of was an aggregate of all of these sort of articles, examples, and sort of tools around sort of creating and crafting style guides and pattern libraries and all of that. And so sure enough, Anna, being the amazing person she is, sort of like the next day is like, oh, and here's the website. And then we basically just started seeding it with a bunch of different content. So now that's a resource, and it's called the styleguides.io is the name of it.
This idea of style guides, I mean, this is something that people have talked about for a long time, but I'm not sure they're always using the phrase the same way. What do you mean when you're talking about a front-end style guide?
Yeah, so I just wrote a post about this, basically running down the various flavors of style guides. So historically, style guides have been sort of brand identity guidelines, right?
Right. I remember seeing a Pepsi style guide a few years back that was, you know, how to use the logo and what colors can you use? And when you have the name Pepsi, but it's not in the logo, what do you do that? And what's the proportional sizes of things and all of those types of things to make sure the brand is always protected?
Yep, yep, exactly. And those things are incredibly valuable, but oftentimes they're sort of locked up in a brand book or like a physical book. Back whenever I used to work at agencies, you know, I would have these books on my desk, which are sort of funny in retrospect. And increasingly more of those things are moving online, which is great. So that's one type of style guide, right? These sort of brand identity style guides. But then there's these sort of emerging ones, these sort of design language style guides, things like Google's material design, but also, you know, IBM just released sort of their design language and stuff as well. And this is, you know, a bit murkier than brand identity guidelines, like here's the logo and here's how you use it. It's more sort of describing a design language and sort of, you know, philosophy almost, but then also sort of how to apply that stuff.
When Apple first came out with the Mac, one of the first things they did was they published this thing called the Apple Human Interface Guidelines. And that was a book that said, okay, this is how menus work, and this is every application should have file, edit, and view as their first three. It shouldn't be view, edit, file, or edit, file, view. It should always be file, edit, view, and opening and closing files is in the file menu, and this is the language, and you should use the command O key to open and the command Q key to quit. Don't assign them to other things. So it was basically this guide that sort of set down these guidelines, in essence, that told you what a proper application was and how it would work. And lots of folks have produced those since then. It's been a popular thing to do, but that's a little different than what you're talking about. That's not really what material is. Material has some of that, but material also has a huge component library that lets you basically build things quickly.
Yeah, and that's sort of what these things are. Again, they're murky things, right? Because they're not totally prescriptive about, you know, always do this, never do this. There's a bit of that. It's sort of part philosophy, part strategy, part brand, but then also part like toolkit. It's like, okay, you know, here's the stuff, go nuts with it, you know, and here's some guidelines for sort of making that happen. It's been sort of fascinating sort of seeing these things emerge. And granted, you know, they're still coming from, you know, the Apples, the Googles, the IBMs of the world. But increasingly, you know, even at sort of relatively small organizations or relatively like less tech savvy, like they're not making operating systems, but they do have a brand. They do have, you know, they're trying to put out a consistent mission, a consistent, you know, sort of tone, a consistent, you know, sort of philosophy. This stuff is starting to make sense just, you know, for everyone, right? Rather than people that are sort of creating these platforms.
Now, part of the goal of style guides, I think, is to shorten design and development time.
That's a huge aspect of it. I mean, I can't count the amount of sort of times I've seen wheels get recreated and reinvented and reinvented just over and over and over again for no other reason than just, you know, Tony sits in the other room than Sarah. Like, that's really the reason why that stuff happens. So, you know, the whole point of sort of creating these style guides is absolutely to save time and effort. And whenever, you know, the boss comes back and says, we need this new section of a website, it's not a, oh crap, that's going to take 5 months and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, we already have all of our pieces in order. All we need to do is, you know, arrange them on the page in the right logical order, put in the new content, and there you go. You have a new section of the site that looks consistent, that you know, stays on brand and all of that stuff without having to totally reinvent the wheel. And this is so massive on a lot of different levels, and especially as somebody that comes from an area where, you know, working at agencies, very often, you know, we were so quick to just ignore or bulldoze those existing standards, those existing sort of interface patterns, those existing sort of looks and feels. We're just like, no, you know, this is our little piece of the puzzle, and we're going to do something crazy and parallax and blah, 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 or whatever, just because we can. We didn't honor, right, the organization's sort of overall structure. So I think that these style guides are becoming just massively important for organizations, especially those that work with sort of contractors and third parties and stuff, to just make sure that everyone is honoring the system that's been created.
Another thing that style guides, I think, does is it allows folks who, because of the structure of the organization, may not be working and collaborating together at the same time and place, come up with something that feels like they actually talk to each other.
Yes. Yeah. And in my experience working with organizations, it is absolutely essential for the actual creation of the style guide. It's absolutely essential to have, I call it, you know, sort of the A team, right? You need a cross-disciplinary, you need all people represented sitting equally at the table to actually create this thing. But once you actually establish your design language, once you establish your style guide and stuff, yeah, then you could delegate and you could have people in other countries or cities or whatever all sort of making use of this style guide, you know, and not have to worry about, you know, whether a developer that's in Romania is going to go rogue and, you know, sort of write their markup in a totally different way or design their own buttons or whatever. They're still able to sort of follow the guidelines that have been put in place by this sort of core group, right? Typically, you know, sort of higher level, sort of like leadership, you know, sort of, you know, smart people to putting this resource together. And then basically all the sort of foot soldiers are able to sort of make use of that. And I think that that's really smart to do, just because you know, those people in those leadership positions can't be everywhere.
Are folks who are implementing these things using an enforcement mechanism? Is there a, you know, you will not be allowed to ship if you do not follow the style guide stuff? Or is it more of a, this is the guideline and we're going to make it really easy for you to implement to this guideline, but if you've got a good reason to not implement to this guideline, go ahead and do that?
Yeah, how effective these things are matters entirely up to sort of how the process, workflow, and organization is structured.
You mean success is based on people actually working together and talking to each other? Is that what you're saying?
I know, it's crazy, right?
Wow, that's crazy talk. Can't we just create a flow chart and then... and then be done with this?
Yeah, there are actually some great tools that do help enforce a lot of this stuff. Actually, there's just a great post this morning sort of about like SAS linting and stuff for your CSS. And basically, if you go rogue, if you write things in your own way, your tools will yell at you. And that's sort of cool, you know, so you can actually have some technology sort of assist and sort of keep people on track and keep things consistent. And that obviously works well for code, but for lots of other things, it matters entirely on the people. But that being said, you know, one of the things I do find, you know, sort of a common complaint for sort of style guide driven design is a lot of the visual folks and stuff are like, yeah, but I can't be creative, right? I can't explore. I can't do my own thing, right? And be blue sky. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, good, whenever those people say things. But that being said, I do think it's important whenever you're crafting these systems to sort of build that flexibility in mind, right? Where it's like, okay, well, here's this hero area. And this hero area, you know, might have a bunch of editorial content or might have some promotional stuff. And that stuff is going to change wildly, right? It's not like you always need to use these three colors and it always needs to be in this layout for this section. It's important to sort of build that flexibility into the system where it's like, here are the areas where you can sort of go crazy, right? Here are the areas where that flexibility is okay. But other areas of the site, you know, doing business parts of the site, right? Like filling out a form and all of that stuff. It's like that stuff needs to more closely follow, you know, the default style guide. So I think it is possible to sort of create a system that simultaneously encourages and enforces sort of, you know, consistency and cohesion, but still gives people the tools they need, you know, the patterns they need in order to sort of be a little more flexible and be a little bit more, you know, I don't want to say the word creative, but, you know, wild or deviant.
Well, I mean, that's one of the big arguments that I often hear about style guides is that it squashes innovation.
Yeah. And that can be true. I mean, like if you're a dictator with it, you know, if you want to roll with an iron fist and be like anybody that so much as, you know, puts one line of text in a non-sanctioned font, you know, like, you know, you're going to get your hands chopped off or something, like that's not good. But again, like it doesn't have to be that way. I think that it makes a ton of sense to establish these languages as a solid guideline and to, you know, 9 times out of 10, just lean on what's already been created to do your work. But if there are valid reasons to deviate from those things, it's like use those opportunities as a conversation starter to be like, hey, you know, we need to do something differently. You know, what can we do about that? And very often what you'll find, I was sort of working with like a big, large retailer right now. It's like very often you'll find there's certain areas that need that extra bit of flexibility or sort of wiggle room within the constraints of the system. So okay, just account for that stuff up front, and that sort of helps keep everybody happy, right? You know, people sort of putting out these very rich, very sort of, you know, image heavy or lettering heavy sort of areas are still able to do their thing while the rest of the system sort of remains intact.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that a team needs to make sure that in addition to putting together this style guide, which has all the mechanics of what a great experience is going to be about, they need to talk about when do we allow deviation from the style guide because it's actually going to make the experience even better? And when do we put up a block to that deviation because it's, you know, creativity for the sake of creativity and not because it's going to make the experience better?
Yep. And that's why I think it's so important for organizations to have people who sort of own and shepherd and sort of enforce these things, right? People that can sort of be those people that are responsible for those decisions and can make the final call. Like, no, fall back in line, you know, use the buttons we've already created, or, okay, this is actually a pretty interesting thing. Maybe we're going to make a new pattern and sort of roll that into the style guide as well. And that's, I think the idea is those deviations might begin their life as deviations, but if it's something that works well, then that should ultimately be rolled into the system, right? The idea is to sort of, you know, build things for reuse and build things for the long run, because maybe you're doing a similar campaign next year, right? And maybe you want to make use of those same patterns that you establish, right? So it's not about like deviating from the system in this big series of one-offs. It's about like, okay, well, you know, the system doesn't do this currently. Here's what we want to do. Let's make it happen. And then really at the end of it, let's roll that stuff in so that new stuff is a part of the system now too.
Absolutely. This is really exciting. And in your workshop that you're going to do at the UX Immersion Conference, you're going to talk about building up atomic designs, putting that into responsive web designs. And will you hit on some of the style guide stuff?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll talk about atomic design and sort of talk about some tools to actually sort of make this stuff happen and also some techniques to sort of get started. At most places I go to, a lot of the challenges around style guides is that they're oftentimes treated as a separate project. And it's like, oh, we don't have the time or the budget, you know, oh, it'd be nice to be able to do this, but, you know, we have a site to get out the door. We have an app to get out the door. And I think that that's, you know, unfortunate sort of myopic thinking. And I think that what I'm going to cover in my workshop will really help teams create their own style guides through the duration of their project, right? So it doesn't have to be a one or the other kind of thing, or, oh, we need to free up some more budget for this. It's no, you could actually just sort of build this into your process and end up creating a new shiny site, but then also creating the underlying system behind that site. So we're going to talk a lot about that, and then also talk about a lot of those molecules and organisms, those things that you could put on to a web experience, put it into an interface, right? How do data tables work across different screen sizes and environments, right? How do carousels work and, you know, modal windows? You know, what happens with those things on small screens? So I think that's a lot of what the workshop is going to cover, is, you know, how to think more systematically with respect to design, how to sort of establish patterns and make that sort of a cornerstone of your process and methodology, and then also, you know, take a look at basically anything you could put onto a screen and how to make that work on all of these different screen sizes and environments.
And you've created this really cool resource that I heard about called styleguides.io.
Yep. Yeah. And so that's what, yeah, Anna Debenham created the front end for it. We've just been sort of seeding it with all sorts of different examples of style guides and articles about style guides and, you know, podcasts and talks and tools and books and all sorts of stuff. So it's basically like a one-stop shop for all things style guide related. So yeah, definitely have been having a lot of fun feeding that with a bunch of content, and more people are sort of adding resources to it as well. So it's a totally open source project. So if anybody has any resources that they want to share, we'd love to have them for sure.
That's amazing. Brad, thank you so much for talking to us about all this today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to April.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And if you're listening to this and you... Of course, if you're not listening to this, then I'm just not going to talk to you. That's just the way it's going to work. But for those of you I am talking to at this very moment, if you want to attend Brad's workshop, you are going to be in for an amazing treat, because this was just the hit from last year's User Experience Immersion Conference. And you just spend this entire day building things up from atoms. We start with an atom maker and you just build them all up. And it's really a fun, informative day. Everybody loved it last year. It's very much a hands-on thing. Just be prepared to do great stuff. And Brad's a genius about this. So come do that. You can find out more information at the conference website. That's the UX Immersion Conference, uxim.co. And it'll be in Salt Lake City, beautiful Salt Lake City, April 13th through 15th. And we're just really excited that Brad's going to be joining us. And it's going to be a ton of fun.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Brad, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks, Jared.
And I want to thank our audience. You guys are awesome. If you have a moment and you really enjoyed this, go to the iTunes and give us a review, and that would be great. And of course, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you again. Take care.
For more information about Brad's and the other five workshops, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. As always, thanks for listening.